The original Grand Funk Railroad. The band, you might recall, recorded a total of 17 albums, total sales, more than 25 million records. Mark Farner is the unmistakable voice, guitarist, and songwriter that powered the original Grand Funk Railroad to 12 platinum and 15 gold albums. After only three guitar lessons, Mark put various bands together in the mid-60s. Mark and his bands played the usual dates that a teenage band would play, you know, high school dances, VFW halls, wedding receptions, stuff like that. Upon leaving high school, Mark turned pro, worked with Terry Knight in the Pack, the Boss Man with Dick Wagner, then just the Pack, this time with no Terry Knight, but with drummer Don Brewer. In 1969, Mark started the original Grand Funk Railroad. With teenage friends, Mel Shaker, I hope I have that right, and Don Brewer, one of the first American power trios, was hence born. Mark and Grand Funk hit big just several months after forming. They were the only unsigned act on the show. When they opened the first day of the Atlanta International Pop Festival in July of 1969, Mark and Grand Funk Railroad played before 180,000 people in 110-degree heat, and there was so much acclaim that they were invited back to close the show the very next day. Following their hugely successful Atlanta appearance, the band was signed by Capitol Records, and their first gold album, On Time, was recorded and released within 4 months. The saga of Grand Funk Railroad is very well documented. The albums included such titles as Grand Funk Railroad Survival, Live Album, Closer to Home, E Pluribus Funk, Phoenix, Good Singing, Good Playing, Caught in the Act, All the Girls in the World Beware, among others. The hit singles, of course, you'll recognize I'm Your Captain, Closer to Home, Foot Stomping Music, We're an American Band, The Locomotion, Mean Mistreater, Bad Time, Some Kind of Wonderful, and others. In 71, Mark and the original Grand Funk Railroad set the attendance record at New York Shea Stadium for a concert surpassing the record by the Beatles in 1966. Did you know that? And a record that, by the way, still stands today about 30 years later. In early 77, Grand Funk called it quits after taking a year or so off. Mark Farner, though, signed a solo deal with Atlantic Records, issued two critically acclaimed albums, Mark Farner and No Frills. In 81, a reunited Grand Funk Railroad recorded two new albums, Grand Funk Lives for Full Moon Warner Brothers Records and What's Funk. Mark released four contemporary Christian albums from 1983 through 94, earning a Dove nomination, reaching the number two chart position with the John Bland composition, Isn't It Amazing? His continuous touring schedule kept him in contact with both his longtime Grand Funk fans and the new fans that first noticed Mark during his solo years. In 95, Mark toured with Ringo Starr's All-Star Band, then toured with the Northwest Airlines All-Stars in 96 before reuniting with Don Brewer and Mel Shaker for a series of benefit concerts that were recorded, released on the double live CD Bosnia for Capitol EMI. Mark toured with the reunited original Grand Funk Railroad in 96, 97, and 98, and was named to Polestar's Top 100 Tours of 1998. VH1, in fact, featured Mark and the original Grand Funk Railroad on a Behind the Music special that has been airing since early 1999. Since 99, Mark Farner has been touring with his own band, Energy. That's N-R-G, Energy. They featured, they're featured on a live DVD recorded at Ichiku Park Rock Festival and have released two CDs, Red, White, and Blue, and Live Energy, recorded in 2003. A new studio CD is currently being recorded, not slowing down a bit. Mark Farner continues to electrify audiences with a mix of his original Grand Funk hits and music from throughout his 35-year professional career. In just a moment, Mark Farner.
Thank you. as I said,
the voice, the guitarist, the songwriter from Grand Funk Railroad, Mark Farner. Mark, welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Good to be here with you, Art.
God, it's great to have you. What part of the country are you in?
In Michigan, the northern tip of the Lower Peninsula.
All right.
Lake Michigan shoreline.
Well, man, you hit it early. 20 years old, that's awfully early to be.
It sure is.
Really making it big. How old are you now? You willing to say?
I'm 57.
57?
Yeah.
Well, I just made 60, so.
Good
listen, man, when you were playing that music, I was playing your music. You know, I was radio station to radio station, top 40 all over the country, so I was playing that stuff.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate it.
You betcha. There was no choice. Believe me, your records hit it so hard and so big that everybody played them. And that must have really felt, I guess, in the beginning. What did it feel like when all of a sudden your records were getting played nationwide?
Well, we were touring. We were doing two major tours a year and then doing two studio albums a year. So we were kind of used up and didn't really realize until well into, you know, years into it, just how big the band had actually gotten. We were kind of kept from the media by the manager, Terry Knight, who recently passed away. He was actually murdered in an apartment in Texas at his daughter's apartment. But,
Oh my God.
Terry wanted to create a mystique, and that's what he was telling us anyways. But we found out that was giving him the opportunity to do interviews and claim himself to be the mentor and creator of all of the great things that were going on with Grand Funk. So.
I see. And they were great things. I mean, you guys were as hot as it gets. From the song American Band, I wonder if that was written, if it was like reality written into a record. I mean, 40 days on tour, Little Rock, Arkansas, bunch of wonderful women and all of that. Did that really happen?
Yes. Every word of it is true.
Every word of it's true, huh? No kidding.
Yeah.
I've got to ask you about that, actually. Playing rock and roll music in the years I did, being a DJ, we had our own groupies. We had a pretty good number of groupies, but nothing like you guys must have experienced. What was it like?
It was a beautiful thing. I mean, for all that male energy in a young man to have the focal of, you know, thousands of women at one time. I mean, the guys were there too, brother. But
it must have been rough.
Yeah,
must have been really rough. The world has changed an awful lot since those days. I see it, and you must too. I mean, what do you see that's so different around you now?
Well, from I've stayed in the music business for all these years, Art, and from my perspective, the freedom that you once had and a lot of my brother DJs out there to grab something while you were on vacation, a tune that you heard while you were in Miami or something, and you come back and spin it for the folks that you're, locally broadcasting to. You're a DJ sitting there. You're a personality, a real person. It's like those days are gone.
They sure are.
And we don't have that kind of influence, that kind of personal touch in the radio. I think it's kind of sterile myself.
It is.
You can go from state to state to state on the tour bus, and I can name you the next song in rotation because Clear Channel owns most of them. It's all this.
You're on Clear Channel, by the way.
Yeah.
I am. I work for Clear Channel.
But it's corporate.
But I mean, you're right. I don't dispute one word you say.
Yeah.
I own a little radio station here in Pahrump, Nevada. My wife and I do.
That's great.
And we have got well over 1,600 records in rotation.
Yeah.
The average station has like 40 or 50 records they play, and man, that's it.
I know.
We've got your stuff all over the place. how could we not? Of course, we're an oldies station, and you and I are both now oldies.
Yeah, we are.
And how do you feel about that? I mean, 20, you were doing that, and now...
Dude, I'm proud to be sucking air, let alone singing music today.
I hear that. Yeah, I hear that. But the world, again, the world is really, really, really different. So I mean, the politics aren't the same. Radio's not the same. I'm sure as hell rock and roll isn't the same. I don't even know if it's rock and roll anymore.
I hear you, brother.
Is it?
No, because the roots are gone. You know, I think the roots have to be in there. But people are gravitating to, I mean, my 16-year-old son, Art, listens to country music because there is a message in the song, and it's not, you know, go out and kill somebody or take your life or be mad or, you know, do something stupid. You know, and I'm seeing a lot of young kids turning to the country because they just don't like that crap.
Moreover, I can't understand that crap. And moreover, it's not even to me, it's not even music. I mean, music had a certain criterion it had to live up to, like, I don't know, having a melody. You know, for starters, some kind of melody anyway.
Yeah.
And then a message on top of that. The music in the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe a few early 80s, that all had a message to it of one kind or another.
Exactly.
And I don't know how important, I mean today, there's records that, you know, they talk about killing, they talk about murder, they talk about killing police and incredible stuff like that. How important is the message in music then and now?
You know, it's critical. It will remain to be critical because these words that you and I say, brother, are very critical. If the truth is contained in what we say, it's critical that people get it. If lies are contained in what we say, it's going to be critical on them.
Yeah.
You know, we're teaching our kids, we're trying to teach our kids how to be real in a make-believe world. Really, it's all under the illusion of the value of money. But, money is valued more than life itself.
You know, during the Vietnam years, we had anti-Vietnam music, a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually Vietnam got up and went away.
Yeah.
Thank God. And music had something to do with that. I mean,
absolutely.
It absolutely had to, that's how important music is. And that's why I'm saying today, you know, if our kids are listening to music urging them to kill cops or something, is that message every bit as strong and as real and as impressive as the one then? I would guess, huh?
You got it. You got it. And I have four sons, Art, and I look and I'm, you know, I try to listen to some of the music that they're listening to part of the time, because my youngest son, Jesse, is the one that's listening to country, but then I got a 22-year-old and a 25-year-old and a 27-year-old, and they all listen to different kinds of music. So I try to listen to it because I know that there's a message in there, and I know that there's a young person who's pissed off, and he's trying to get his message across in the best way that he knows how, or they know how. And so I've listened to some, you know, some good music, I mean, some good lyrics, but it's just hard for me to listen to because it doesn't have the criteria that I'm looking for, which is, like you said, art, you know, what about the melody? What about somebody actually singing it? You know, harmony.
And there were an awful lot of songs about love.
Yeah.
There were songs about, I don't know, a lot of things, just plain old rock and roll, partying and whatever, you know.
But not
the kind of stuff we have today. And I guess I'm wondering how much of an influence it has on the way our society is going to act as they grow up.
Well, I think we're going to see it. It's not going to be good already because of, you know, when I was young, I didn't have TV for a while. I mean, I listened to the Lone Ranger and the Creaking Door and stuff on the radio. Man, I remember, you know, sitting with my cousins and listening to the radio. And then TV comes along and projects all these images into our young people's minds. And today, TV is so, God, it's so corrupt. I mean, as far as, you know, they promote violence and they glorify guns and drug use. They glorify all this stuff and make video games for our kids to play where they can chop people's heads off and knock their, I mean, you know, blood running down the hallways, and it's all this violence, violence, violence.
There actually was a new video game the other day that CNN ran a story on that, you know, the central theme of the video game is how many police you can kill.
Yeah.
In the game.
Unbelievable.
You see that?
And it's in this world that we're living in where we're hearing that music. I think that those images that have been projected into their young minds are, it's validated. We're raising soldiers. I mean, these kids that are playing the video games, they see a commercial that the Air Force is running on, and it, this guy is sitting in this Mach 3 helicopter's up, you know, and every way he turns his head, the laser sight turns the gun, and it seems like a big video game, so they, you know, it's fun and games until their buddy falls dead next to them and his blood is soaking into the sand, then reality hits.
Yeah, that's right. There was a schism that happened between you and the rest of Grand Funk. Can you talk to that at all?
Yeah. Well,
what happened?
You know, we got back together after I did the Ringo Starr tour. We got back together in 96, and they wanted me to stop touring. Don and Mel wanted me to stop touring solo for the time period that I was going to be out with them. And I said, well, I'll do that, but only for 2 years. And I actually put in an additional year because the first year was kind of light. We were being booked by Punch Andrews, Bob Seger's manager, and managed by them. And then we moved on after that and did the Behind the Music thing with the VH1. But at the end of that third year, then I was going to go back and do my solo, like I told them. And then they went, well, we want to keep going. I said, well, too bad, because the agreement was 2 years, and I've put in three, so I'm really going to go do this. I can't do this anymore. You know, I mean, the reunion was fun, but I got my solo career, and we had talked about this previously, and then all of a sudden they go, well, we remember you saying that, but we don't remember it being 2 years. Anyways, it was just a bunch of crap, and because the corporation, GFR, controls the trademark. Don Brewer came to me one day, and he's gone to law school, and I never graduated high school, which I'm not proud of that, but I just to let you know that I don't know much about law in itself. But Don told me that if I signed my ownership of the corporation or my trademark into the corporation, that it would have some kind of a protective umbrella or something. It sounded good to me, and I said, okay, cool, let's do it. And then the next thing you know, they're voting me out, telling me they're going to go on the road and they're going to get replacements for me, and there's not a thing I can do about it because I'm only one third of the corporation.
Well, maybe a third, but I mean, you were the voice.
Yeah.
You were writing the music.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big third.
Yeah, 90-some percent of the music.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's heavy duty. So I don't see how they could take such cavalier attitude.
Well, deceit works in this world, and it seems like, you know, it's just, it's okay. So what you lie to get elected? You could become president. Just lie your butt off, man, you know.
I've long said, I don't think it actually would be possible in modern society to be elected president of the United States without lying.
Exactly.
I don't think it could be done.
I'm with you.
In fact, I doubt you can even get to the House or the Senate without lots of big ones.
Oh, yeah.
So all right, so the big break. It seems like, why'd all the big groups break up?
I think it's a lot of it is ego, to tell you the truth. I mean, you know, and we think so much of ourselves, and, well, you can't tell me that because I'm the one that made that, and, oh, you know, God, it's just back and forth, and, well, I'm the one responsible for that, and I'm, you know.
Is it a natural thing to occur because you're always worried that, you know, like you're just part, your success is just because you're part of a group, and somehow I'm sure you want to prove to yourself. Mark, you have a book out. You had it out for, what, a couple of years. What is the name of your book?
It's From Grand Funk to Grace.
From Grand Funk to Grace, that's great. And what, it's the story of Grand Funk?
It's my story, which includes the years of Grand Funk, but also tells about my father, who was a War II vet, tank driver in the 7th Armored Division, my mother, who was the first female welder at Fisher Body, where they were making Sherman tanks, the kind that my dad drove.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite a story. Christopher Englehart, the author, is a Michigan resident, knows the whole the history of Michigan and the different groups that, of course, a lot of music came out of Michigan because I believe from the auto factories being there that it drew people from all over the United States, different various types of, you know, musical tastes, especially from, well, my mother's side of the family was Leechville, Arkansas, and my Grandpa Cotton, Uncle Woody, everybody moved to Flint, Michigan to get these high-paying auto factory jobs. It brought a lot of musicians into the area that, you know, combined their musical talents with other musicians who were brought in from there, and so we had a nice pool of talent in Michigan. A lot of bands came out of the area, and so Chris put together the whole book in a really good way. I mean, you know, kids, he's very meticulous about detail, and I'm very satisfied with the job that was done on it.
All right. So if you want to know the story, that's how. It's available, I don't know, Amazon.com probably, right?
Right. And the author's website, which is 6270@charter.net, and my website, markfarner.com.
All right. Excellent. Remember Rick Nelson's garden party?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He had a rough experience with the garden. And I wonder if that translates. I mean, sometimes when you go and you play and you lay down the old stuff and you lay down the new stuff, do you ever get a garden party kind of feeling, you know, like they want to hear the old stuff, they don't want to hear the new stuff?
Well, I keep enough of it in there because I've got so much music to pull from all the albums, and the people that, you know, the hardcore fans that come to see me, they like to hear all that three-piece stuff that I just, you know, some obscure song like "People, Let's Stop the War." I mean, it's very apropos today.
God, it is again, isn't it?
Yes, and I wrote it during the Vietnam era, of course, and it was big then. But it's it gets a good reception today, and
yeah, I can see why.
Yeah,
but so you've got plenty to pull from that's new, and you've got plenty to pull from that's old, really.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I don't do, you know, the contemporary Christian albums that I made, actually there was three of them. One was like a compilation. That was on a contemporary Christian label. But when I would go to churches and when I would, you know, play at these religious functions and tell people that, you know, God didn't need their money and stuff, I mean, I wasn't welcome back to a lot. I believe in an unconditional love, and that's the way I read it. And that's the way it works for me. It's the unconditional love of God shown to all people from the beginning to the end of time. And he loves us all the same, and we're all in. And any of this other crap don't apply.
So you got religion or always had it?
No, I got the truth. I got, you know, what I believe. That from first I got into the religious part of it, and I jumped through the religious hoops because I thought, you know, here I was a sinner, sending my ass off out here in the world. I better go to church and get saved. And I went through all of the motions, and you know that was, it's not fulfilling because you got to do things. I mean, you got to become like that whatever sect of, you know, Christianity it is. I mean, there's over 2,000 denominations of the Protestant faith alone. Which one do you pick to go to? And there's all kinds of spin-offs and different, you know, Catholicism and everything that you can get into with it. It's the Bible, but anybody that's not preaching the unconditional love or, you know, teaching the unconditional love is teaching a false Jesus, because, you know, that was supposed to be the propitiation for all sins of all the world for all time. And, you know,
in view of the way you feel and your religion, I've heard that you had a UFO sighting.
Absolutely.
And... Yeah. And I'd be most interested to hear about it and how it fits into what you believe.
Okay. Well, let me tell you about it. It was the first one I saw, which was the most up close and real. It was only maybe 100 yards away from us. I say us because once I pulled in the driveway with the keyboard player, I was the boss man at the time, and the keyboard player, Warren Keith, who ended up playing piano for Hank Williams Jr., he was driving his Cadillac. We pulled in at my folks' house to stop over and sleep until, you know, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning when we got there. We were going to get up and go the rest of the way in the morning. So I go up and I'm crawling through the window because we had an old farmhouse and the skeleton, you know, skeleton keys were gone and we just locked the screen door and my mother would leave a sliding window unlocked. I'd slide it open, crawl through, and I'm about halfway in, halfway out, and I hear Warren give this war whoop out in the driveway and I just bust my ass and jump off the porch and run out there and he dropped his satchel alongside of him and he's just standing there looking off into the field across the street, and I ran past the shadow of the corner of the house because it was like a full moon lit night, and as soon as I broke into the moonlight, I looked over there, and here is this flying saucer. And I mean, this thing had to be 200 feet in diameter. It was huge. It was in that like a haze. It had some lights, little tiny lights twinkling around the middle of it, like kind of like the sun hits a woman's diamond, how it throws the facets, throw the colored light.
You could make out the solid shape of a disc.
Yes, and I dove through the window on my way back into the house, hollering to the top of my lungs, get out of bed, get out. And I ran in, and my mom, stepdad were like trying to, you know, rub it off. What's going on? I said, get out on the porch out front now. And so all my brothers and sisters, my mom, stepdad, get out on the front porch, and here this thing is, still sitting there, not making a sound, not making a motion or anything, just, and it was almost like, dang, is this thing real? Is that being projected into the atmosphere? What is this, you know? And we're all in awe standing there, and I didn't think of, you know, taking a picture or whatever. I'm just thinking, what the hell is going on here,
of
you know?
Course, yes, of
it's
course.
That close.
Of course.
And then we all looked at each other because we felt our guts start to quiver. I felt a low frequency, and I didn't realize what it was until it became audible. You know, it was sub-hearing when we felt it because it was shaking our bodies. And then as it became audible and raised in pitch, it went boom and got to a real high pitch and then just went shot right across the sky. I mean, faster than your imagination.
Now, that's a really close encounter. That's a really close encounter.
Oh, buddy.
Any effects from it? After effects, other than shock?
Well, it caused a lot of questions.
I bet.
Like, where the hell did that come from? And who was in it? You know? And I don't think it has any, you know, varying effect on what I believe as far as the unconditional love of God. I just am, because that's my creator, you know, and my mother's side, I'm Cherokee Indian, and in fact, I was given the Cherokee Medal of Honor last year, and it's the creator, and we refer to him within the Cherokee, you know, the Cherokee Nation, and the creator created that. I don't know what for.
Mark, do you think that what you saw was not of this earth? I'm sure that you've turned that over in your mind enough times.
Yes, I considered whether it was or wasn't. And in order for somebody to survive that kind of takeoff, I mean, I don't even know of a G-suit that would keep you from, you know, just
turning into a pancake.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, with that kind of an experience, if you think they're not of this earth, that would change a lot of things. Or actually, we go around about this all the time on this program, you know, spirituality and religion versus the possibility that what if we were put here by them?
And they're keeping track of us?
Yeah. that's one thought, yes.
Yeah. That's you know, it's all speculation, of course, but after seeing that, and well, let me tell you just one little addition to that, Art, because my cousin who lived in the neighboring town had a water business, so water softeners, water distillers, you know, water purifiers, and
sure.
He was into it. I was out seeing him, and I was telling him, this is the first time I'd ever told anybody about this, because my mother told us if we had ever said anything to anybody, that she was, you know, she was going to kill us, because back then, in 68, of course, it was all the swamp gas and the weather balloons and all these things that people said were UFOs. And they came off as kooks in the paper, and she didn't want to be a kook or any of us to be labeled as kooks.
A lot of people understand that, believe me.
Yes. She said, just keep it to yourself. So anyways, I was out at my cousin's, and I'm telling him about this sighting. And as I'm telling him, the door to his office is open. His secretary walks around the corner. She's crying. She says, Mr. Hall, I don't mean to bother you, but can I come in here right now? And he's going, what's going on, Captain? Well, then she told the story because she'd heard me telling my cousin, Don, and she actually lived a quarter mile down the crossroad, which was only a quarter mile away
right.
from where I was at, saw the same night, the same year, I mean, you know, and when it took off, it went to the east, which would have been over the top of her house, and that's the way it took off. And then she asked me, what does this mean? I mean, here this girl is. I'd never, you know,
yes.
share this with anybody. And she just happens to be there and just happened to live a quarter of a mile, you know.
What did you tell her? Do you recall?
Well, I told her because she was crying. I mean, she was just losing it. And she thought, you know, had something to do with God. And I just calmed her down. I said, I don't think it has anything to do with, you know, or supposed to. She says, well, what is this supposed to mean? What do we do with it? I
yes.
said, sit on. I don't know. You don't try to, you know, manufacture something within yourself. Let's just go on what is. And what is the next thing that happens, you know, in the next second.
I mean, a million things could run through your head. Seeing
oh
something
God.
As close as you did, you could think we were being invaded. You could
yeah.
think a million different things could go through your mind. How much from where you were standing when you saw this disc, how big would you describe the disc? And by that I mean, like, we all know how big a full moon looks up in the sky, right? We
right.
know how big certain things look. So how big was it to you?
It appeared to be about 200 feet in diameter.
Filling up how much of the sky?
Oh, it was huge. Because it was only 100 yards away from us. I mean, it was just over across the street in the field, and the full moon had it just illuminated. And like I said, it had this haze around it. Oh, and one thing, when it took off, Art, the haze that was surrounding this saucer
yes.
stayed in the shape of a smoke ring. It was like a haze ring, but it was a billowing. It was just kept rolling and rolling and rolling.
That also makes sense, though. I can see it just blasted up through it, so it would have left like a smoke ring.
Yeah, and in the morning when I got up, which was, you know, real early because I was still excited about seeing this thing, I look out the window and I'm looking. I know I'm not going to see it, but I'm looking for any kind of trace. And, man, that smoke ring was still there about maybe 10 times larger than it was when it started, but still rolling.
Well, you're lucky. You're lucky that you have other people that saw it. A lot of people,
oh, yeah.
you know, they have these sightings alone, and I guess for the rest of their life, they have to wonder if this was something, you know, a product of their own brain somehow or another. You don't have to wonder that.
No.
And that's not the only sighting you had, is it?
No, it's not. We were at a recording studio in Florida, and we saw, well, we couldn't make out the crafts, but we saw the lights and the radical movements of these crafts that were over the ocean. And Mel had gone out to smoke a cigarette, and he come running back in. He says, you guys come and see this, man. I ain't believing what's going on out here. And we all walked out there and said, got to be UFOs. You know, nothing moves like that. I mean, straight down and in a hard 90 at a fast rate of speed.
Do you have any personal theories, Mark, on whether, I don't know, whether contact actually has been made, whether this is something that our government is fully aware of and has made some sort of deal with them? Many people believe that. You think that our government knows what the hell's flying around in our skies?
Well, I believe so. I do. I do have, I won't mention any names, but I do have friends that are in the government.
All right. I can imagine that.
Told me and showed me a few things that made me aware that the government is fully aware of what's going on. And I don't know to what degree the involvement is.
Can you share any of those generally, if you have to?
Well, this one person actually investigated crash sites, UFO crash sites, and this person was very good with the hieroglyphics and all this other stuff. Very into the detail and what she showed us was pictures.
Oh.
Yes, of things that. I mean, you would think that they were out of a magazine or something.
This was a military person?
Well, yes.
Or a government person?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
And I believe because they told us that they had been threatened, that this person was threatened by the government to move up. They wanted to move up in a position, in a higher position in the organization that covered this. And
uh-huh.
She didn't want to because, it was, she has children and she got, concerns. And so they bugged her house. Every time she'd go out, she'd come back and do the sweep and find bugs. And, I mean, they were watching her like a hawk, but what saved her life is her taking the files, I believe. And because that file's in her possession, she's got...
Are you talking about these files that you were shown?
Yes. Yeah. Now,
obviously, I've got to ask, do you have copies of these files?
Oh, no.
No? Could
no.
you? Are
I didn't even want copies of them. I looked at that and I said, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
This is what's going on? Okay.
Do you think those files still exist?
Oh, yeah. I believe so.
Oh.
And I know inside there's a lot of them that exist, but
and you know who has them.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Do you think this person, before they leave us, will want to make this public?
I don't know. There was quite a fear put into them.
Uh-huh.
The whole family.
Yeah, I've heard that story a lot, Mark.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I didn't expect this much. Do me a favor, if you ever have the opportunity to talk to this female again,
yes.
And she would like to let loose or blow the whistle, as it were,
uh-huh.
We're available.
Yeah. Okay.
In the meantime,
I definitely, because I think people are, there's enough fear out there. We don't need more fear. We need understanding. And
you're right about that.
Talking about it.
All right, listen, my friend. It has been an honor to have you on the program.
Thank you, Brother Art. I appreciate the time and sure appreciate you and your good work over the years. You still got a great voice, bro.
Here's what happened. Robert Dean up here in a moment. We mourned the loss of our Abbey Cat. Just, a couple of days of heavy mourning, and we both looked at each other and said, let's get a kitten. So, raced to the phone, called the animal shelter. Ah, they were closed. Too late. You know me, day sleeper, right? So, I thought, you know what? We own a radio station. Why don't we put an announcement on the air and see if anybody's got any kittens ready for adoption? And so I put on one announcement, one very tiny, brief announcement. If anybody had a litter and they had kittens, and by the time that announcement, 2 seconds had passed, it might not have even finished airing, and the phone rang. He said, I've got exactly what you need. And boy, did he ever. Right across town here in Pahrump, newly born, Dusty was the first one handed to me when I walked through the door. I put her on my knee. Mama jumped up, and they said, gee, that's strange. She never gets on laps. Licked her little kitty goodbye, and Dusty has been ours. Dusty, well, I'll tell you more about Dusty as time goes on, but Dusty is... if you could actually maintain this level of energy and harness it, you would solve the nation's oil problems. We'll be right back. Anyway, that's a little dusty in the webcam photograph. Be my guest. Take a look. God, what a bundle of joy. All right. Coming up, actually an extension of last hour in a way. But I think it's going to be shocking for you. I have a feeling this is going to be a, I don't know, kind of a shocking interview. Robert Dean, retired actually, Command Sergeant Major Robert Dean, served on the front lines of Korea and Vietnam as a highly decorated combat veteran. Stationed at NATO Shape Command Headquarters in France during the 60s, he had access to classified documents confirming government knowledge of the extraterrestrial reality. A prominent and internationally recognized speaker, he has countless television, radio, video, and news documentary appearances to his credit. In addition, Mr. Dean has been involved in UFO research for more than 40 years and has been honored with 2 Lifetime Achievement Awards for his contribution to the world of ufology. That said, I think you're in for a really big shock coming up. Robert, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Art.
It's great to have you.
Be back. It's been a while since we spoke.
It has been, hasn't it? Actually, how long, Robert?
Oh, I think you had me on, Art, over about 10 years ago.
10 years ago?
Yeah.
10 years ago.
95, 96, I think.
Yeah, it has been a very, very long time. And I said to my audience, by the way, stay good and close to that phone because you're not too loud. I said to my audience, it'll probably be a shocking interview. At least I think it will be, because I do recall the last interview we did. And here it says that you've stopped speaking out on the alien presence. Huh?
Yeah. I'm afraid so, Art, yeah.
Yeah?
A lot has happened over the years. I, as you may remember, I spoke out rather bluntly and rather loudly for a long time.
Exactly.
I was trying to get, I and a bunch of guys that I worked with closely together, a lot of active duty and retired fellows from all of the services.
Right.
Air Force, Army, Navy. We created what we call the Old Boys Network. And Art, we tried simply by, you know, speaking out publicly at conferences and such, and radio interviews, to get people attention to the fact that we were addressing the greatest issue, and I believed it then and believe it now, the greatest issue in the history of the human race. And that's simply that we're not alone, Art, and we've never been alone. And what we tried to do, and many of us were, you know, taking a chance, we violated our national security oaths. Over the years, we wanted Congress to have open hearings. And we promised Congress that we would fill their hearing room with hundreds of retiree and even active duty guys who would tell the truth on the issue.
Robert, I'm friends with some people pretty high up in ufology in more ways than one, and I won't name them, but they tried to get a hearing going in Congress.
Oh, I've known Stephen Greer for years.
And they got very close. It's actually not Stephen Greer I'm talking about, though. Certainly he's fought like crazy for that. I mean, there are a number of people, some of them very, very well placed, wealthy, influential, that kind of thing. And it always got canceled, Robert. It always got ditched.
Well, Art, it seems that we're facing a monolithic problem here. There is what I call, and I think you're probably pretty aware of it, what we would call the black government. And this organization or this group of people actually exists. Now, you don't read about them in the newspaper, and they're not the kind of people that you see elected to the House or to the Senate, and they're not the kind of people that get appointed to national office. These are guys that have tremendous power. They never get elected.
Are these military people?
Yes, many of them are. I'll give you a name right off the top here. And this
you sure you want to do that?
Stuff. But have you ever heard the name of Bobby Ray Hinman?
Of course.
Well, Bobby Ray is up to his neck, not only in the reality of it, but in the cover-up itself. And he's only one of a couple of hundred, I think, of top-ranking military people who are a part of this. Now, a lot of them are involved in the national security apparatus, you know, National Security Agency, CIA, DIA, NRO. There are guys in all of those organizations who are involved.
You're describing kind of a Majestic 12.
Well, Majestic 12, Art, actually exists. Now, I don't think they call themselves that anymore. I think they go by another title, but they really do exist. And there are a lot of top people who are in there. And I've run into a couple of them over the years.
Well, arose by any other name, still.
Yeah, yeah. They're doing the same job, and they're trying to... Art, they're scared to death to bring a lot of this out.
If you, Robert, if you were to try to relate to us what you think their mission is,
well,
how would you describe it?
I think that they're simply trying to control the reality of the massive extraterrestrial presence, to keep it from the mass of people, and to utilize it to contain and control the power they've got. Art, this is the biggest story in human history.
If this is true, Robert, of course it is.
It's not merely national, Art. It's multinational.
Well...
Have you ever heard of an organization called, well, a treaty called the Yucusa Pact?
It seems like I've heard the name.
UK-USA. We signed a treaty back in 1947. Interesting year, by the way.
All the way around, yes.
Yeah, we signed a treaty with the Brits primarily, and this Yucusa Treaty was an agreement that the United States, Great Britain, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand would share sensitive national security information only among themselves. Now, that treaty still exists, and that organization still exists.
All right, but that referred to traditional national security, if there is such a word as it applies to national security. I mean, I do understand such a treaty, but do we know for sure that that included the existence of extraterrestrial presence on Earth and perhaps even technology from them?
Well, in 1947, they created the treaty. But in 1950, they included the extraterrestrial reality because it became apparent, I think, to the British government and to the American government that in terms of national security for all of the signees of the pact, that the extraterrestrial reality was one of the most sensitive and dangerous areas of all. And they still continued that, and we still share with the Brits, and the Brits share with us and the Australians. Good God, Art, one of our biggest national security agency facilities is located smack dab in the middle of Australia at a place called Pine Gap.
I have no problem believing that there exists this kind of agreement.
Yeah.
No problem whatsoever. Sure it does. It exists. The question, though, again, is whether a big part of that is extraterrestrial presence. How do you know that to be true?
Art, over the years, I've cultivated a lot of contacts and a lot of friends. I was in the military for 27 years. And then I worked in FEMA for another 14 years.
Huh.
And I maintained a high security classification through all of those years of government service. And I had access to and coordination and communication with people from all services, all over the country and all over the world. Art, I've had people come up to me in England when I was speaking at conferences over there.
Yes.
Who shared information with me off the record. And we respected each other. We learned to trust each other. And I've been provided information over the years that literally curled my hair. And I was able to share information with some of them. During those years I had those clearances, Art, I had access to classified material. I had a cosmic top secret while I was at Shape NATO.
Cosmic top secret.
Cosmic top secret.
Now,
it was and still is the highest level of security classification that NATO has.
All right. That in mind, that gave you access to documents that touched on this kind of thing?
Oh, I've stuck my nose into filing cabinets all over the place, Art.
Oh.
Digging, peeling out, pulling information out, sharing with people. You know, there is a kind of a fellowship among professional military people. And we took advantage of that. We developed a level of trust among ourselves, and we shared information because many of them, not merely myself, have been convinced from the very beginning that this extraterrestrial reality is so important.
Can you tell me what documents you saw and where, if you're able to, and when?
Well, the first one that really got me started was when I, in 1964, at Paris, they concluded a three-year study while I was there. I was at Shape NATO there from 63 to 67.
Right.
And in 61, there was an incident that occurred, Art, in the morning of the 2nd of February, 1961, when World War III damn near started. Is that there was a massive flyover of unidentified objects coming out of the Soviet sector, the Warsaw Pact area.
Oh, boy.
Flying out of the east toward the west, flew over France, flew over Germany, over the southern coast of England, and these objects flew in formation at a very high altitude and a very high rate of speed, and they turned north over the southern coast of England, and they disappeared off NATO radar off the over the Norwegian Sea.
I wonder how close NATO got to advising some sort of reaction. In other words, how close to World War III?
We went to red alert. This was a couple of years before I got there, but the guys who were there told me that we thought that was the end. Everybody went to red alert. They found out that the Warsaw Pact had done the same damn thing. That we were just probably with moments away from World War III. And then by the 15 or 20 minutes, it was all over. These high-flying objects in formation, metallic, obviously under intelligent control, turned north over the southern coast of England.
Do you recall anything about the speed?
Oh, at a high rate of speed, Art. You know, 800,000 miles an hour, faster than anything we had in those days. Faster than anything the Soviets had.
How fast again, please?
Well, from anywhere from 600 to 1,000 miles an hour.
Okay, all right.
And there were times when they kicked it up and they would disappear off radar 2,500 to 3,000 miles an hour.
Huh.
They didn't stick around very long in those days for us to monitor and compute and figure out exactly. But over the years, Art, they had been flying all over Central Europe, and I'll tell you, they still are.
And you saw documents supporting, that whole incident?
Well, I got there in 63, and as I was assigned to the war room, a place we called SHOC, the Supreme Headquarters Operations Center. And in 1964, when they completed the study, they put a copy of the damn thing in the vault in the war room.
Uh-huh.
And we used to be in there on 8, 10, 12-hour shifts, Art. And sometimes at 2 and 3 in the morning, you'd get bored and the coffee was too dark to drink and you'd read all the old newspapers.
Yes.
Boredom, you know, that's the old military story.
I could tell you stories, but not enough years have passed.
90% of boredom and 10% pure terror.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyhow, an Air Force colonel who was the controller on duty that morning, he saw that I was kind of nodding off, and I was bored and twiddling my thumbs. He went to the vault and pulled this document out. He threw it on my desk, and he said, "Master Sergeant, read this." He says, "This will wake you up." That was the beginning. I read the damn thing. Heart, I couldn't put it down.
Okay, and so that incident beginning to end? Was there more? Or what?
It was a total of a three-year study. Art, they started it in 61. Based on this one particular incident. But they had devoted a full 3 years to analyzing and trying to figure out just what the hell was going on, what are these objects, who do they belong to,
yes,
where are they coming from, and why are they here? They published the document in 1964, in the summer. I took a look at it, and my life changed. I had never really ever been the same. And that was the beginning for me, Art. That kicked off what I call a 40-year research program of trying to really come to terms what's going on.
Did this report conclude anything, by the way?
I'm sorry?
Did this report conclude anything about the incident? Did it conclude in some way what they thought it was?
Well, they concluded, Art, that apparently the planet and the human race had been under some kind of an observation or a survey of some kind.
They actually included that?
They concluded that,
oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
They concluded, first of all, that it was not a military threat to Allied forces in Europe, which was the whole reason the study was established.
Huh.
In the 3-year study, they concluded that apparently we have been under some kind of a survey or observation for a very long time by one or more, got this, extraterrestrial civilizations. Now, they published this in NATO in 64, Art. I was to learn later that our own government had known this as early as 1950.
But, Robert, you know, even in years later, the U.S. government in the military continues to say, whatever these things are, we've concluded that they are not a threat to national security.
That's exactly what the NATO study concluded in 64. They concluded, Art, that if these objects, if this civilization, if this technology were hostile or malevolent, that the game would have been up a long time ago.
Yeah, I'll vote
they
for that.
They repeatedly demonstrated technology that was so far beyond anything we had. Art, they used to fly circles around our high-performance fighters. They would do foolish things. They would make us, you know, they went out of their way, apparently, to show us what they could do, what they were capable of. And the conclusions reached is that they apparently were not malevolent or hostile.
But
we also concluded in 64 that this had been going on for a hell of a long time.
Good morning again, Robert. Robert, I described a kind of a cycle a few minutes ago, and you know, my good friend John Lear, I've known John long, long time now, and he's a very wise man, but he, like everybody, has their ups and their downs, and John has come to me a couple times and said, hey, Art, you know, I want to go on the air and just say, I don't believe in this anymore. I don't, you know, it was all a bunch of junk. I mean, he's come full circle in a lot of ways, Robert. You may recall the Lear test.
I was amused when John ran you through that test, Art.
You were amused?
Yeah.
Because
John was right on.
Yeah.
And you reached a conclusion, if I remember, that if everything he had to say was true,
then
no, you wouldn't let it out either.
That's right. That's absolutely correct.
Well, that's the conclusion that I and many others have reached after many years. I've been at this, Art, for 40 years.
I know.
I know John. I've been in his home. I have a great regard for him.
Yes, so do I.
He's a member of the Old Boys Network.
Yes.
And he reached the same conclusion I have, that it's too soon, the people are not ready, and the government is sure as hell not ready to let anything out.
Can you recall or name or agree with or disagree with any of the things that John said?
Well, I don't remember it exactly, Art, but I can tell you a few basic reasons that I've concluded about why this can't come out.
That'll
not
do.
Only now, but maybe not for another 50 years.
That's fine.
And that is that the theological implications are absolutely mind-boggling. There has been evidence that has been collected by respectable people in the military and in the national security agencies over the years.
Yes.
That these intelligences, one in particular, but there are several, at least I knew about four different groups that are some time back. One particular group has an agenda that is deeply involved in the human species. And there is evidence that they had a hand in not only initiating, but establishing most of the major religions on this planet.
Hmm.
Now, just stop for a moment and look at the world news today and look what we're dealing with. Look at the fundamentalists and the blood that's being shed.
Yes.
Over religion.
Yes.
And it's heartbreaking and it's shocking when you stop to think about it, that we're all human beings on one little tiny planet. And here we are divided not only politically, but religiously and sociologically. and we're blowing the hell out of each other.
As absolutely divided as we could be. I can't see how we could be more divided than we are at the moment.
Well, I'm afraid we could get a bit more divided. I think this damn war in Iraq could grow out of proportion, and I think we could end up with World War III if we're not very careful. And then, of course, we got this mess with the North Koreans, for God's sake.
How do you see the possibility of World War III?
Oh, God.
How can you imagine that would even occur, growing out of the situation we now have in Iraq?
Well, when you consider that the Israelis have nuclear capability.
They do, indeed.
And you consider that Pakistan has it.
They do, yes.
And Musharraf, I think, is hanging on by a mere thread, Art.
You think that government's close to being taken over?
Well, it could. Well, they tried to kill him three or four times.
Yes,
they've gotten
yes.
damn close a couple of times.
That's correct, yes.
If he's gone, if he's not there to hold that together, I have a feeling we're going to have Al-Qaeda running the show over there.
And an Al-Qaeda bomb.
And Al-Qaeda having their finger on a nuclear trigger.
That's unthinkable.
Well, it is unthinkable, and yet, in all the years I worked in FEMA, Art, that was one of the things we had to think about. The reality and the possibility of a Third World War. The average American, Art, has no idea how close we came during those Cold War years. We and the Soviets, it was not just the Cuban Missile Crisis. There were two or three other incidents that most people have no idea about.
Well, I was in the military for the Cuban Missile Crisis, so I remember it exceptionally well, thank you.
I remember it vividly, yeah.
I do, yes.
That was a close-run thing.
And I thought that was the end.
Well, I
but
thought
you're,
so, too.
You're telling me that there... Well, you described one already, where World War III damn near started, with some sort of craft from elsewhere.
Yeah.
Do you know of others, other incidents?
Well, there have been a number of incidents that have caused us to jack up the national security level. You know, we had UFOs hovering over our ICBM bases, Art.
I'm aware.
There have at least a half a dozen cases, one particularly that I knew about, over Minot, South Dakota.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I am aware of that. I'm also aware of an incident in Russia.
Yeah.
A similar incident, a different outcome.
They scared the hell out of those guys in the Soviet Union.
Well, they did scare the Soviet Union, and they sure as hell scared us. They disabled, I forget how many of our ICBMs, but they did in fact do that. I've interviewed people who were in those silos. Robert, I know it's true.
Listen, this one in Minot, Art, they not only got inside the silo, they lifted the lid off the damn thing, which I think is about 20 tons. They lifted it off like you'd look. You and I would move a box of crackers. They got in there. They were hovering over the facility. The kids in the security unit were practically, you know, having a fit. This thing hovered over the silo, lifted the lid off. When they finally got into it later, they found out that not only had the warhead been melted, but the computerized guidance system had been so scrambled that if the Minuteman had ever got out of the silo, God knows where it would have ever gone.
Well, I heard about the scrambled circuitry. In fact, I heard they were just disabled. I didn't hear the exact details. I talked to one man who was called in to actually work on the circuitry after this occurred to try and figure out what the hell had happened. They never did. But I had not heard about the melted warhead.
Melted the warhead.
That's a new one.
The Minuteman at that time, I don't know whether they still do or not, but it had 10 multiple targeted warheads on the end of the damn thing.
Right, MIRVed.
And they ran somewhere from 5 to 10 megatons each. Now, that's almost unbelievable in itself.
Now, with
they melted the warhead, scrambled the delivery system or the guidance system.
Yes.
And then flew away.
Yes. Now, they did
that
here,
get attention
and they did it in Russia, Robert. What do you think the message was?
Ah, well, I believe there were at least a half a dozen of these incidents that I'm aware of, which you probably are aware of.
I know of some,
yes. I think that's a message, Art. And, you know, interestingly enough, the one about Minot, this happened during Reagan got elected in, what, 80? This incident at Minot occurred in 82. And you know, after that and the Soviet experience, did you notice how many summit meetings took place between Gorbachev and Reagan?
I certainly did.
And do you think that that might have been a factor?
I also recall President Reagan saying things that seemed to come right off the wall about what if we had a common enemy.
Yeah. Gorbachev said the same thing. So those guys paid attention. The message, I think, was pretty clear. That, you know, here we are, a primitive and savage society, and here we've got thermonuclear capability. And I think they made the point and made it very clear that, hey, we're not going to allow you guys to do this. Well, I hope the hell they're still watching, because we're still doing stupid things.
We are. And as you pointed out, proliferation is going like gangbusters here, and eventually the wrong people are going to get a bomb. Do you think it can be held to the use of one or two bombs, or do you think once something like that, once that hell is unleashed on Earth?
Oh, God. Art, I think if the first time they pop one, that there's going to be at least a dozen others.
You do.
I do believe, and I'm sorry to tell you that, because, you know, I spent all those years in FEMA, and we were working on the continuity of government and the nuclear threat and all the rest of it. And I happen to remember that back during the years I was in FEMA, we had national policy that if something were to happen and something were to begin, they decided that they would not tell the public.
At any stage?
Well, after. And they would wait until after the strike, and then they would start cleaning up the mess. But I sat in on some of these conferences, and yet the idea came up. If we know that the Soviets are launching, and they're going to hit New York and Washington, do we tell the American people? And the answer was, hell no.
No.
Because all we would do is have them all out on the highways, running like hell for their lives, and they would be totally exposed to the blast. So their policy was then, and it still is, if something is on its way or it's bad happening, we'll let it happen and then we'll try to clean up.
I guess I can imagine such a policy.
Yeah, it was pretty well thought out.
And should we expect soon something like that to happen?
Well, I happen to know that the policy in the highest levels right now, and I've gotten this from some very, very dependable and reliable sources, that the policy is not to tell the public about the extraterrestrial reality. And that if the guys upstairs, as the Canadian researcher years ago said, the boys upstairs, if they decide to end the cover-up, they can do it any damn time. But we're not going to do it on a national level.
Let's talk a little bit about motive of this one particular species. What exactly is it that they're doing that it would be so impossible to reveal?
Well, you remember what John was telling you.
I do.
Okay. One of the things that we've been able to piece together over the years from a variety of sources, and I'm talking about extremely reliable sources of information, is that this one particular group, as I said, we knew of four. There may be as many as a dozen, I don't know. But we knew of four. But the one particular group that seems to have an intimate involvement in us, I think these guys had a hand in our being here. I think they had a hand in our being genetically manipulated a long time ago into Homo sapiens.
Well,
they have an investment, I think, in the human race.
You're quite correct. Yeah.
they not only had a hand in creating us.
Mm-hmm.
Every major religion on the planet tells you essentially the same story. But Art, they have had an intimate interrelationship with us, and I say an intimate interrelationship with us, for good God, perhaps 10,000 years. And these are the guys, I think, that would like to see the human race survive. I really do believe that there is a level of benevolence there, that they would like to see us make it, because I think they have a bit of an investment in us.
Well, they would, yes. They'd be our creators, I guess. That alone would keep it from getting out, of course.
Hey, that is another one of the reasons why the cover-up How does a government decide one fine day, hey, let's go out and tell the American people, let's have an announcement, we'll have a big press conference, and we'll tell them everything we know. It was like John said.
This was, yeah, the heart of the Lear test.
Can you imagine trying to tell the mass of American people that they are a hybrid species, that they have been genetically created? Look at the argument going on right now among the evolutionists and the creationists.
Yes.
You know,
no,
I've been a great
believer in intelligent
design for a long time.
They couldn't say that, Robert. They just couldn't say it. I mean, that's all there is to it. They couldn't say it. They would break the back of this country. They would break the back of the world.
Well, that's right. So that's why our people like John and myself, and we're not by ourselves, we've reached a conclusion, Art, that there's no way it's going to get divulged at any time soon. You know, I've tried to talk to Stephen Greer about this.
Yes.
Bless his heart, he's a sweet man. He's really tried real hard.
Yes, I've had the same talk with Stephen.
But he's a bit naive. He doesn't realize what he's up against.
Well, think of this way, Robert. He's you at an earlier stage. I mean, there's a certain cycle to all of this discovery.
Oh, yeah.
Then you want to tell the world. He's still in the I want to tell the world sort
it's
of stage.
It's a learning curve, Art.
So you've chatted with him, but it doesn't go anywhere exactly, right?
Well, Stephen, as I said, is a sweet man, and he keeps having these press conferences every year. And he brings in a lot of people. A lot of my old cronies go with him to Washington, and they stand up and tell in the National Press Club what they've learned. And what happens? It doesn't get to first base. The Washington Post, the New York Times, you know, CNN, nobody pays attention.
That's all true.
And I think the government's damn happy about it because they want to keep the lid on this thing. So, Art, what I've done over the years, that you know, I'm getting up there. I turned 76 here in March.
Huh?
And I've decided that I have got some living in my life to do, and I'm doing some serious remote viewing.
Now, that's interesting. You've turned to remote viewing?
Well, you know, I have a great respect. I was inspired some years ago by Ingo Swann, Robert Monroe, Pat Price, Joe McMonigle. I had a chat with Joe up in Las Vegas here not too long ago. And Claude Swanson. You know Claude.
I know all of them.
Yeah, well, I have been doing some serious remote viewing, Art, and I have found that is what I'm going to be doing with the remainder of my days.
That's quite a statement, Robert.
I call it soul travel, Art.
Well, I guess in a way it is.
It's the only way to travel these days.
The only way to travel.
I ain't about to put myself through that crap at the airport.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something I've learned. I know you're interested in this yourself, but you got to be cautious when you remote view the ETs. They sense your presence, and they will often follow you home out of curiosity.
Okay,
I mean, when you start remote viewing into them, like Ingo did and Pat Price did, when he got inside their bases here on the planet.
Then with your background, I suppose it would be completely irresistible.
Anyhow, they will follow you home. They'll walk right into your living room, so to speak. But I have learned a great deal with my remote viewing, and I tell you honestly, Art, it has brought me to a point where I have become totally aware of the immortality of the human soul. And that, to me, is important.
That's a very large conclusion to come to. On what basis do you come to it?
Well, I have had a couple of, you know, near-death experiences. And that'll make a believer out of you. And it struck me, and it has become very apparent to me, Art, that we are immortal souls enjoying a temporary human physical, you know, existence. We're here at this level of existence only for a very short period of time.
Well, you're so lucky that you know that.
Well, I've learned that, Art. It hasn't been an easy journey. But I've accepted that, and it's become very clear to me, and that's what I'm going to be devoting and what remainder of my years to.
Sold from...
If it's just Al-Qaeda, then that's one thing. But if a large part of the population of the world actually hates our guts so much, hates us so much, has realized that there is no chance whatsoever that we will convert, then their position is that we have to be killed, that the infidels must die. There is no bargaining they wish to do with us. They've already, in their minds, tried that. And so now the infidels must simply be killed. That would be all of us. Now, the Christian world is not about to change. That's not happening. So if this is not just Al-Qaeda, but this is a large part of the world, Robert, then we are looking at World War III. And when they get the bomb... that could well be the beginning of the end, indeed. So, you know, rather than fight a war, Robert, if we had irrefutable evidence that, in fact, our makers were not as we think, not God, if Jesus really did not walk on earth, if... Buddha wasn't here, or wasn't the real thing, or, you know, if all of this is untrue, then why would it not be in the interest of a world organization, an international organization that would have the knowledge you say they have, to go ahead and shock the world, and shock the world so hard, so completely, so irrefutably, that all religions questioned their faith, and realize there might not be any reason to fight.
Are you asking me, Art?
I'm asking you, yeah. In other words, why wouldn't revelation of all of this, you know, after the shock wore off, if it did, and if we didn't destroy ourselves just trying to, you know, digest that knowledge, but once we got past all that, if you could get past it, you would have a world that wouldn't want to kill each other because of different beliefs, because there'd only be one worth considering.
You know, Art, all the years that I spoke out and traveled and, you know, went at conferences and this and that, I had the belief, and to some degree I still hold this belief, that if we could learn the truth about the fact that we're not alone, that we've never been alone,
yes.
If we could learn the truth that we are a hybrid race, that
yes.
we have been... created from a lower form,
yes,
and that we have had an advanced intelligence deeply involved in our lives from the very beginning. I had always believed that the release of that information would bring about an expansion of consciousness in the human race that would perhaps hopefully bring us all together. Now, I still, to some level, believe that. If we could get that information out to the people without having all hell breaking loose, that it might somehow bring us together.
Well, make no mistake, all hell would break loose. but what I'm getting at is that after all hell broke loose and got finished doing as much as it was going to do, then you'd have a different world situation.
Preferable to nuclear war.
A lot of things are preferable to nuclear war, and that certainly would be one of them. I, for one, would not have difficulty absorbing that knowledge without going berserk and getting a rifle and going to a high tower somewhere and picking off civilians or something. You know, I mean, I really could handle it.
I think you could, too. And Art, I've always believed this. Your listening audience is not typical.
You're right. You're absolutely right about that. You're right. A lot in the audience would say the same thing
Your listening audience is about 10 or 12 cuts above the average American out there, in my opinion. I believe this for a long time.
In terms of possibly embracing the otherwise unembraceable. Yeah, I agree with you, Robert.
They listen to your program, and you have some pretty stimulating, mind-boggling things on.
So how do you I try to explain this to my audience all the time, Robert, that they're one thing, and then the larger world is something else altogether.
That's the thing that bothers me, yeah. I was surfing on the tube the other night. It's almost impossible to find anything decent to watch anymore on television. But I was surfing on the tube, and I surfed across a religious station. And Art, so help me God, there was a fundamentalist preacher on there that was literally frothing at the mouth. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was so excited, and he was banging his fist and thumping his Bible, and he was literally screaming into the camera. And do you know what he was all about? Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code.
Really?
And I thought to myself, in the name of God, what is it that's stimulating this man to such frenzy?
Mm-hmm.
The idea that Jesus of Nazareth was married and had a family and had kids? Is that what it's all about? And I thought to myself, that's frightening. If this guy is even partially typical of his community, of the people he preaches to, you know, how can you bring out the reality of that beautiful young man from Galilee 2,000 years ago really did live, was married, had kids, and probably some of those, you know, the family probably still exists. The bloodline is probably still in existence. But how can you get that past people?
Well, you can't. And I don't know how I explain my audience, Robert. I can only tell you that when we have things of this nature discussed, it would do my audience good to sit down and have to read my email, for example, the email that comes from the Bible Belt, from this big, monstrous population in Middle America. And it's, if anything showed up, Robert, any alien creature at all showed up to these people, I promise you, it would not be an alien. It would be the devil.
Well, that's the other thing that worries me, is that so many of the fundamentalists look upon these guys as being demons.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, they simply don't know what the hell they're talking about. They've not done their homework. They really haven't.
Well, but they have done their homework in the sense that... they've been educated all their lives about what such a thing would be. And it's not their fault that that's their belief system. It's how they've been educated, literally, Robert. Well, so, I mean, they believe that these are devils. And there's a lot of people who believe this, Robert. Not just a few, but
I know.
A lot.
I know. It frightens me.
I'm inundated with emails from them. So I know it's true, but it's hard to impress some of the perhaps more sophisticates, you know, on both coasts and some throughout Middle America that believe differently. And, you know, they listen to this program, their minds are open to various things, and life would go on if they had this knowledge.
Well, your listeners, Art, are pretty special people. And I think many of them have already accepted some of the things we're talking about tonight. And their life is going on. And they're looking beyond, and I think those are the people who have the future of the human race in their hands.
Trouble is, Robert, there's not enough of them,
okay.
And there's a lot of those others. And then, of course, there really is a force in this world that has decided we're not going to convert, therefore we need to be killed.
Yeah.
So I don't know what takes the place of that, Robert, other than the kind of knowledge you're talking about, that would take the place of it. If we got to the right people, Robert, if the right people decided to talk, could it be absolutely irrefutably proven that it's true, that it's all true, that we've been getting visited for a very long time, and that these are our makers?
Well, they're our family, Art. That's one of the things that I always try to look at, that these guys are literally family.
Could it be proven irrefutably?
I think it could be. I think it will be eventually. I keep having a little hope in the back of my mind. You know, I've gotten kind of cynical as I've gotten older. I'm an ornery old cuss. I've tried to be civil and human and you know, love everybody and all that. But I've had a feeling in the back of my mind that maybe, just possibly, the gang upstairs, the boys upstairs, might decide to drop down and intervene in a big way. And that would bring it all out. There would be hell to pay for a while.
Do you know what conditions might cause that intervention?
Yes, if we got to a point where we were ready to trigger a nuclear war, I think that might happen. They have already demonstrated time and time again in the Soviet Union and the United States that we're playing with this thermonuclear capability, and they don't appreciate it, and they've let us know that. I think, Art, they just might decide to have a massive, major intervention before we started a nuclear war. Maybe I'm just grasping at straws, but I hope that would happen.
I would hope with you that it would happen, but I don't know, Robert.
In the meantime, one of the reasons I was pleased to be invited to come back on your show is that maybe we could reach a few people tonight, you know, get a few people to think about the extent of this. And I try very hard not to be cynical. I mean, I've asked people, I've spoken to people publicly. I said, what if you were to find out that their aliens are all over this planet? They have major installations. They have one inside of a mountain in Alaska. They have one underground in the middle of Australia. They have another one in the mountains of the Pyrenees, south of France. And where the hell is the other one? Oh, it's in Africa.
In Africa.
Near Lake Victoria, yeah. Pat Price remote-viewed them some years ago.
These could not exist without the knowledge and even cooperation of the governments involved.
Exactly, exactly. But that's only part of it. How, if you tell them that the human race is a hybrid, that we have been genetically upgraded, that there have been what I like to call periodic intervention, that, you know, intelligent design, so to speak, that maybe that a few people will come around and think, hey, these guys are not to be feared. Maybe they're pretty decent guys. Maybe they're not demons after all. But I've had mixed reviews, Art. I've gotten along with a few people who accept that, and others are, look at me like I'm a representative of the devil himself.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people, of course, definitely don't want to believe any of this, and very much hold on to what they believe. And this is true of, I fear we're at the edge of this war. Take me back to Inman, would you please? You said Inman was up to his neck in all of this.
Well, Bobby Ray, as you may remember, was I think he was a director of the National Security Agency.
Yes, indeed.
And he was a deputy director of CIA. And in his position over the years, he was deeply involved in not only the reality, but the cover-up. And now he's working for one of the largest aerospace industry organizations on the planet. And as I said, if anybody is a member of, you know, Majestic 12, Bobby Ray is. And I really do believe that he is probably in the policy-making level. But we've never been able to get him to come forward. I mean, he's been very courteous, but he won't, you know, he's very, very cool. He won't say very much.
What attempts have you made?
Well, there have been several phone calls before he retired, actually, while he was still in the NSA. A number of researchers have been able to reach him by phone. And he's been very candid and honest, and he says, well, much of this will come out eventually. And that's about as far as he would go. But I use him as an example of a people who are in the very highest level of national security and government who are now working for aerospace industries, who are probably the major secret holders of all time.
These beings who are here, Robert, there are many different ones, apparently.
Well, I learned before I got out of the military that we knew of four. But there apparently is one group that we have had some communication with.
Huh.
You heard the rumor, the old story, about Eisenhower supposedly meeting them out in the desert here years ago while he was still in office?
Yes, I've heard the story.
Well, I happen to have talked to a man, a researcher by the name of Jamie Chandra, who you ought to try to get on your show sometime. Jamie saw the film of that whole incident taking place. They filmed it.
That was filmed?
It was filmed. And what's interesting about it is that the guys that show up on the film, there were three golden discs that showed up, hovered over the runway there, and one landed. And a bunch of guys got out, humanoids, you know, tall guys. They didn't look exactly human. Their eyes, their noses, and their faces were somewhat different.
All of this is captured on film.
It's all on film. Now, if we could show that...
With President Eisenhower there.
Exactly, yeah.
You're right. If we could show that... Well, I don't know. We live in an odd age, Robert. We really do. Where people are disinclined to even believe what they see.
Look at the alien autopsy, Art.
Yes.
Remember that?
Vividly, yes.
Would you believe it? I'll tell you frankly, and this is no bull, that was real.
I have had a number of people say that to me recently, that that was real.
The alien autopsy film that caused such a stink.
Was real.
That British researcher in such a mess.
Oh, yes. I was in on that from the very beginning.
That was real, Art. But look what people did with it. You know, oh, it couldn't be real. Nah, that was all set up. That was phony.
You know, interestingly, I never heard anything that actually... trashed that actually, in my mind anyway, proved that wasn't true. I never heard a thing.
They've never come out with any kind of proof that it wasn't true, because the fact is that it was true.
That it was.
Yeah. But you can't convince people of that. You know, if they don't want to believe Art, they're not going to believe.
So then maybe a film of Eisenhower with discs and apparent extraterrestrial beings by this modern society would be just scoffed at.
Yeah.
Somebody made this up, you know. It's Photoshopped deluxe.
What you can do with computers these days.
Yeah, exactly.
Look at what's on television. They make, you know, look, Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Well, all true. Nevertheless, I feel compelled to ask you about this film. I mean, is there any chance that anybody could lay their hands on it?
Well, I haven't talked to Jamie Chandra for some years. He has done what I think John Lear and I have done. I think he's gone to Earth. I think he's just fed up with the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a common circle for ufologists to make, isn't it, Robert?
It's what I call a learning curve, Art.
Right.
Yeah.
A learning curve.
And on top of it, many of us, you know, John Lear is no spring chicken. I'm not sure how old John is. I turned 76. You just turned 60.
That's right.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you.
But, you know, many of us are getting up there. Jamie Chandra, I think, is in his late 60s. And then you've got people who, you know, who have been involved deeply in the UFO thing for years who said, hell with it, I just walk away. I can't put up with this anymore.
Do you think, Robert, perhaps Stephen Greer aside, he may be a special case, but do you think that most other researchers from our era are getting close to this complete circle?
Yes, I think so. I think it's happening. I think it's a natural circle to follow. I think that this curve that we're on is a natural process. And now I'm devoting myself to some serious remote viewing, and I'm, you know, I'm learning the soul science that I think is important for me.
Not all come in ships, because, well, we've had a number of very well-credentialed, very believable people come on the air and say they have seen, through night vision equipment and otherwise, beings actually crawling out from some kind of hole, some sort of dimensional gap that suddenly appeared, and creatures or beings crawling out of these damn things. Now, you have something to say about this multidimensional factor, don't you, Robert?
Yeah, that's one of the other factors that I think has scared the government so damn much, is how do you accept, not only accept it to yourself, but explain to people that we are apparently living in a universe that's literally crammed with intelligent life, and that apparently some of that intelligent life comes into our universe from time to time from other dimensions. Art NIDS actually got that on film before they closed down their operation up there.
I'm aware of that, Ron.
I'm sure you were, yeah. Yeah, that I think Colm Kelleher mentioned it one time. But
that's right.
I'd love to have seen the film, but they actually have a film of apparently an interdimensional portal being opened.
They absolutely do.
Of guys coming through. Well,
yes.
Yeah, on top of, you know, it's not funny, it's kind of sad, but on top of trying to get people to accept the idea that we're being visited from other planets and perhaps other star systems and other galaxies, how do you get them to get used to the idea that we've got people dropping in from other universes?
I have no idea how you get them used to that.
Yeah.
But you believe that to be the case, then?
Oh, I know it to be the case. I'm a great admirer of Michio Kaku, and he in so much in some of his books, he's pointed out.
Yes. Theoretical physicists, that's correct, believe there'd be 11 or more dimensions.
Yeah, I've concluded that we are confronted by what Nietzsche would call a type 2 civilization, at least type 2, maybe a type 3, God knows. You know.
And you believe that their interest in us is as our creators?
Well, I believe that the one group...
That one group.
Yeah, had a hand in genetically upgrading us to a point, and they've nurtured us over the centuries. And I say nurtured, they've literally created most of the major religions on the planet. And I do believe that they have an attitude like, you know, we've got some involvement here. We have some investment with these guys. And I think they'd like to see the human race make it, because I believe they are related to us. There have been...
Why, Robert, would they create religions?
Well, it's a good teaching experience, Art.
It's going to be a barrier to the realization of their existence.
You see, I have accepted that today. I think religion is one of the biggest obstacles that we face in trying to reach a point where we look upon each other as human fellows and, you know, brotherhood of the human race. I think religion is probably one of the greatest obstacles. But I think initially, the way they were taught and initially the way they began is that they probably attempted to do something fairly decent. They tried to teach some basic laws about love and brotherhood and how to treat your fellow man and things to do and not to do. You know, I think the Ten Commandments is an attempt to try to get these barbaric savages to stop pummeling the hell out of each other and get along together. But over the years, human beings have taken religion and twisted it, used it for their own purposes, and now it's a barrier. I one of the reasons I'm doing remote viewing, and one of the reasons I'm talking about it and encouraging other people to do it, is it opens a doorway for you, a doorway, I call it, you know, to another realm of existence. A spiritual doorway, so to speak, that transcends religion.
Transcends religion.
Yeah. Taking the very best of all of the world's religions, discarding the stuff that talks about, you know, blood and gore and hatred and all that.
Yes.
And look at us in a spiritual sense. Look at us as one human species, one family of man. And, you know, if we could look at it spiritually and understand that every human being on this planet has an immortal soul.
But all of our history is filled with bloodshed and murder and violence, and it was in the Bible. I mean, it's always been with us.
I know. You know, Art, I don't have an answer. If I did, I'd win a Nobel Prize. I simply have learned over the years, in my 76 years, that I am an immortal soul, and I live forever, and I'm I'm finishing up a 76-year educational experience inside of a three-dimensional human body.
Mm-hmm.
And once I leave here, I will go off to another schoolroom somewhere else. Or I might come back. You know, reincarnation is a reality that I learned to accept years and years ago.
You believe so?
Oh, no question about it. Matter of fact, I've had a couple of past life regressions, Art, which is, I can tell you honestly, you talk about a soul-shaking experience.
I'm sure that would do it.
A past life regression can really shake you up some, but it does give you perspective.
Well, you've been remote viewing. I assume that you had certain things that you wanted to know. I would imagine the alien agenda and presence was one of those things.
Yeah, I purposely wanted to visit some of the places that Ingo Swann told me about.
Have you?
Yes. And as I told you earlier, when your presence, and I call it a soul travel, when you get into their presence, they sense that you're there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how, but they do. They sense that you're there, and they want to know who you are and what you're doing. Nosing around in their
in their world.
Yeah, and so they have a tendency sometimes. You know, you get scared to death and you go whoops and you head back home, so to speak, and they'll sometimes follow you home. And they walk right into your living room, you might say.
Yes, you've said that several times. So I'm beginning to conclude that a few have followed you home, eh?
Yes, and that's a sobering experience.
I'm certain it is. It doesn't cause you to stop or to question, perhaps, what you're doing.
Well, Bob Monroe said many times before he died, he said, you have to get over that. You have to learn to accept that and not get frightened about it because, he says, there's nothing to be afraid of.
Well, is that really true? Now, I've interviewed, over the years, Robert, a lot of ufologists, and there are a few who say the belief that all of these different aliens are friends of ours and wish us nothing but well is naive at best and really dangerous at worst, that a lot of them do not have our best interests at heart at all.
Well, physically, in a physical dimension.
The one we live in.
The one we live in, and
yes.
The one that many of them are living in.
Yes.
That's true, Art. There apparently are at least four, maybe a half a dozen different groups, and they have agendas that are different. They have motives and purposes and agendas that are at variance with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them don't much like us as human beings. They think of us as primitive and savage and dangerous. And frankly, Art, so do I. But anyhow, there are those out there that they may not necessarily be malevolent, but they're sure as hell not benevolent either. They have an agenda of their own.
All right. I have a lot of people who wish to speak to you. And so I want to start taking a few calls. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Robert Dean. Good morning.
Hi. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning.
It's been great listening to you. I was just wondering, I believe, as an Orthodox Jew, that possibly this is just a form of the one Creator and in his creation dealing with us as human beings as time progresses on. And specifically when you were mentioning something about the Soviet nuclear and the American nuclear, how it was able to push and move away a 20-ton cover, I was thinking that's possibly that one Creator, you know, caring for us as humans and, you know, making sure that we continue and understand that we shouldn't maybe delve into the wrong places. What do you think about that, possibly, being that one Creator? What do you think about that?
Okay. Robert?
That's a very thoughtful question. I've reached that same conclusion that there this one group, Art, this one that's been trying to educate us, as it were, so to speak, over the years, that this is a no-no and that should not be done. And I think that they have a purpose of educating us to the point that we will stop playing silly-ass games with thermonuclear weapons, that I think they really would like to see us survive. You know, I've talked a lot with Zachariah Sitchin. I've known him for years. And, you know, he's got this attitude that the Anunnaki came down and genetically created us as a species.
To mine gold.
And well, that was their premise, primary purpose, of course. But they created us as a slave race. And then along the way, a couple of their leaders decided that, you know, we had some potential. And they started looking upon us as children and members of their family. Now, I don't know whether it's the Anunnaki that Zechariah has been talking about that would like to see us make it, but I think this one group has made it very clear that they are basically benevolent, that they'd like to see the human race survive.
I wonder if it's in their specific personal interest to see us survive, or if our passing as a species would mean something truly negative to their species. I wonder how closely tied we are.
Well, as I say, I think an Anunnaki could walk down the street and you'd never know the difference between a human being and one of them.
It's a good point. It's a very good point. If they were out there and they looked like the rest of us, you could pass a million of them and you would not know it.
That's right. Well, you know, in one of the books of Genesis, I forget which one. I'm not that much of a biblical scholar, but the Elohim, the Anunnaki, essentially say, "Let us make man in our image," and they use their genetics to bump us up into the creature that we are today. So we are family. I think their genetics and ours are the same. The DNA, I think, probably, if we ever develop enough of a science. Of DNA.
Robert, we're getting close. We're toying with DNA. We're beginning to toy with DNA.
We're beginning to do, Art, what they did 10,000 years ago.
We're a quick study. It's come pretty quick. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Robert Dean. Hello.
Hello, Art. Hello, Dean. This is John out of Kansas City. Listening to KCMO.
Yes, sir.
I'm getting up my age, too, but a lot of this stuff, I just don't see where you know, it's really all that secret anymore. I used to work for NASA.
Maybe, sir. To this audience, maybe. To this audience, maybe. But to everybody else, come on.
Well, like I said, I worked for NASA and Wack and Hud and up at Wright Patton and stuff like that. You just don't really realize how right on you all are with what you've been saying tonight. You're virtually pretty much right on track. But the question I got for you was, you know, a person that's seen and knows some things, you know, you go tell people and no one believes you. But why is it or who is it that holds their thumb over the media to the point that they won't go to do simple things that could verify all that, locations, where things are and stuff.
Okay, your question is a very legit one about the media, Robert. Who's got their finger and how is the media controlled? Since I'm in the media, I'm really interested in the answer to this one.
Mr. Bell, I have to tell you, you're a damn maverick. You're not typical. You're like your listening audience. You're not typical in any sense.
No, I'm not typical.
Listen,
that's right.
And answer the question about the media, and I've asked myself the same damn thing. Follow the money, Art. Follow the money.
Well,
media is not independent. Never has been.
But the media is always... The media, it does follow the money, Robert. It follows the ratings, and that's just like saying following the money. The ratings equal money, money equals ratings. It's a hard, absolute fact of broadcasting, whether it's radio or television or any, it doesn't matter. Money, ratings. Ratings, money. Same thing.
Well, when you consider the guys who own the media, I mean, they literally own it. Those are the guys that make the decisions, I think, as to how much you're going to learn and how much they're going to let out. And how much truth they're going to let you have this week and maybe next week. And maybe next year we'll give you a little bit more. I don't believe the media, and I've been interviewed by guys, some of the major newspapers in this country. And I've sat down with these reporters and I've given them an honest 2 hours of my time. And I've laid out the stuff that I've seen, the stuff I've learned, the stuff I've concluded. I've given them facts, I've given them references, I've talked to talk to them about other people they could check with to verify what I was telling them.
Yes.
And do you know not one bit of that ever got into the press?
I guess I'm not surprised, Robert. Or remember the Phoenix Lights, Robert?
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, okay, good.
Sadly enough, here, I wasn't here when that happened.
Here we have craft over a major U.S. city seen by zillions of people. We've got photographs of it. We've got it all well documented. It went on the night it happened, it went nuts here on the show, call after call. I mean, you could have taken a million calls on the night it happened. And then there were several months of absolute silence in the media, the big media.
Yeah.
And then, just like somebody threw a switch, Robert, all of a sudden ABC and NBC and CBS all at once covered it like it happened yesterday.
Yeah, I remember that.
It's like somebody threw a switch.
Somebody did throw a switch. Somebody said, well, let's let that out. And what we'll do is we'll tell the story of flares. The Air Force dropped flares. So they confronted it, and then they covered it up with goo. And everybody believed the Air Force dropping flares. Well, anybody who saw those things, Art, will never accept the flares.
No.
I mean, look what you and your lovely lady saw that night when you were driving along the road.
Oh, I know.
We've had one of those over Phoenix here in the last month. One of those big triangles.
I'm well aware. I've seen the photographs.
But, you know, the guys talk about it. There's even film, but the media hasn't picked up on that. The media never picked up on the Hudson Valley flap, which lasted for almost over a year.
Well, I guess we're both mystified. I mean, hell, I work in the media, and I can't answer the question of how it works, how it operates, who's got their finger on the switch, how it's thrown. I don't know any of that.
It's almost like somebody says, we'll let out just a little, only so much, but no more. And I think that's what they do.
It is almost like that. I mean, it's just unimaginable that that occurred in the way I describe, and boy, it did occur that way.
I've talked to some of these reporters, and they're bright young men. They're bright kids. And I've said to them, what's the chance of what I've just shared with you getting into the paper? And they say, well, I'm going to write it, but my editor might not buy it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right.
And you've got editors in radio and television, the same as you have in newsprint. Somebody edits the reporter's story.
Well, that's true, Robert. Hold tight. We're at the top of another hour. That is true, except in my case. I mean, I can guarantee you, in all the years that I've been doing this, all those years. So, if you have questions for the Robert Dean, he's our guest tonight, and I'm going to be very interested, actually, in what you're asked. Just one more from me, Robert, which encompasses a couple of points here. One is, you believe we're facing the loss of the U.S. Constitution, and you think this comes through some sort of national security state that... is now in existence, growing, and will eventually simply erode all of our rights in the war on?
Art, I'll be blunt with you. I think we've lost most of our Constitution already. I think we began losing it probably in 1947 when we passed the National Security Act. And that was the beginning, I think. And it's been kind of whittled down and diced up and nibbled here and nibbled there,
yes,
over the years, until the Constitution is really in tatters. Look, for example, Art, if I may use just simply one example, look at the monetary problem. Look at the national debt. Congress is supposed to keep its eye on and maintain control over expenditures of funds. They're supposed to not allow us to get into such a deficit. But look what happened here. Just about a year ago, actually it was less than a year, the General Accounting Office came out with a fact that the Department of Defense had misplaced, they don't know where it went, $3.5 trillion. Now, this was not spent. This was simply misplaced. They don't know where the money went. Now, if Congress was conducting a proper oversight, which they are required to do by the Constitution, that kind of thing could never have happened.
$3.5 trillion.
$3.5 trillion. And it made the newspapers one day, and then it just died. You know, I thought to myself, name of God, why aren't the congressmen standing up? Why aren't the guys in the Senate standing up, screaming bloody murder, demanding to know where that money went?
I must admit, I didn't hear that myself. $3.5 trillion.
It was over the course of about 2 years. They couldn't account for it. They don't know where it went.
That's a lot of money to lose.
Oh, my God. Well, that's only one example. You know, the Constitution literally is in tatters. The other issue right now that I'm angry as hell about, my son is a career naval officer. He's not in harm's way at the moment. He's in London.
Yes.
But look, Art, we are in the middle of a war, and Congress did not declare war.
Well, we haven't done that in quite a while.
Well, yeah, I was in Korea, for God's sake,
uh-huh.
And that was undeclared.
That's right. That's what I'm pointing out.
And we're supposed to, we're supposed to keep our hands on that kind of thing.
Yes. There was just the most recent Supreme Court thing on eminent domain. I mean, everybody's hot about that.
Yeah, look at that.
I know. Look at
that's
that is right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Robert Dean. Hello.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, this is Kyle in Washington State.
Yes, Kyle.
Mr. Dean, I have a couple questions, and please don't think I'm arguing any of the facts that you've brought up. First, it's hard to see a logical reason why the government would keep a lot of secrets from us as far as, you know, alien civilizations and whatnot, unless it was, you know, for a whole keeping us from the bad news. I mean, if they already have control and the power and technology, what does it benefit to keep us in the dark at this point?
Well, you have a good question, Kyle. All I can do is point to the old Brookings report, which was finalized and given to Congress in 1961. They concluded, I think Margaret Mead was a contributor to that, that any society that is confronted with an incredibly advanced other society, which are so far beyond them, that shock alone could lead to the destruction of the more primitive society. And I think that's become national policy ever since 1961.
Well, now, from 1961 until now, we've had tons and tons of Hollywood movies and television shows, and everything has been so sensationalized as far as, you know, aliens and spacecraft and space travel.
Yes.
I mean, it just seems that maybe, I don't know, it just seems that maybe we wouldn't be such a big shock to everybody.
Caller, why do you think we had such a blast of exposure to all things alien in our media?
Oh, I totally believe that has to do with maybe a long, drawn-out desensitization process. You know, I mean, why else would we have the whole idea of, I mean, ideas and fantasy come from something, and it has to be, you know, I mean, somebody had to have seen something at some point to start the whole role.
Kyle, a number of years ago, I told Art himself that I believed that he was part of a long-term disclosure project himself, even without knowing it.
Yeah, I know. It's occurred to me, Robert. It's absolutely occurred to me. Not that they had anything to do with the formation of this format or what we do here or any of the rest of that, because it just ain't so. However, perhaps what I started doing was convenient for someone.
Exactly. You started people thinking, Art, and I think the government, or at least the guys that are making the policy, think that that's probably a good beginning.
And it is as much a reason why I exist now as any. On the international line, you're on the air with Robert Dean. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I was wondering if Mr. Dean had ever heard of a gentleman by the name, actually I think he was on Coast to Coast before, by the name of Prophet Yahweh.
Yes. Yes. Yahweh. I've been getting communications from Yahweh recently, by the way.
And I remember seeing a news report where an actually reporter took him to a park, and he actually summoned one on the news.
Absolutely correct, Channel 13.
Yeah.
And get this, caller. I'm going to let you in on a little secret.
Okay.
This Yahweh fellow
now
is writing me emails saying the reason he's been in a dry spell, not been able to call up any lately, is because they, in quotes, want me, Art Bell, there with Yahweh to confirm this, and they're angry that I'm not there, and so they're not showing up when he calls them.
Okay.
I'm not kidding you.
I was thinking perhaps Washington, D.C. might be a better locale, but...
That's it. That's it. Let's ask Robert. Robert, there is this fellow, this man, calls himself the Prophet Yahweh, out here in the desert, from Las Vegas, you know, around the southern Nevada area. He's been saying he can call in spacecraft, and I must say, he took a reporter from Channel 13, ABC, in Las Vegas out, and damn well called one in, and they caught it on camera, and they ran the story. Now, that's pretty weird, but true.
Well, Art, I'll tell you, honestly, if he gets a hold of George Knapp, and you know George.
I know George, yes.
And if he can get George to go out with him in the desert, and George can be go with him and film it, then I'll start to believe it.
Then you'll start to believe it. You
then
mean
I might
that,
even
that
join,
he could call them.
I'll join you and George Knapp, and we'll all go out to the desert and say hello.
As a remote viewer, Robert, has it occurred to you to attempt it yourself?
I have, Art.
Excuse me?
I have.
And?
Well, I've gotten some results, but, you know, it's not what you'd call a big ship hovering over my house.
Try me.
I've had a few visitors here at the house.
Visitors?
Yeah.
What kind of visitors?
Well, guys from somewhere else.
And you believe this as a result of your remote viewing?
I think so. I think what I did is I stuck my nose into some of their affairs, particularly in the facility up in Alaska. That was one that particularly interested me because Ingo Swann had told me that he was actually physically taken there one time.
You're not referring to HARP, are you?
No.
Some other facility in Alaska.
No, listen, I know you know Ingo, and I know you respect him.
Yes.
He's got a book called Penetration. And in that book, he tells about being physically taken up to Alaska by somebody from the Department of Defense, one of the intelligence groups, who took him up there one night near that facility under that mountain. So I began to stick my nose into that, and I had people, or I had intelligences, I had a consciousness show up in my house. And I haven't shared this with very hardly anybody.
And, that's a wow, definitely.
Yeah, well, when you start getting intelligences and presences show up in your living room, you talk about a wow.
Yes, it's a wow. Did you get communication?
Yeah, sort of a curiosity, what the hell are you doing? And I tried to explain what I was doing, and then they left. So I haven't actually tried to call any of them up in the sky. I may try that sometime, but...
Well, if you're able to do what you just said, then doesn't it make it at least partly possible that this Yahweh character can do what he says?
Well, listen, Art, I've seen so damn much in my life that I would never say Yahweh is a nutcase. No. He may be doing exactly what he says he's doing. But
well,
as I said, I'd love to see George out there, you and he and George some night. And if you guys can call one in, then I'll come up and shake Yahweh's hand.
You got it. All right, Robert. First time caller line, you're on the air with Robert Dean. Good morning.
How you doing, gentlemen?
Quite well.
Okay, George, let me tell you, first of all, I'm scared. George has what?
I don't know. George isn't here.
Yeah, but he has three guest hosts coming in next week, so that does not mean you're relinquishing the weekends. Is that correct?
George is on vacation, sir.
Okay. So the guest hosts are...
He's on vacation all next week.
Well, let me give you a 15-second brief history. I was born Roman Catholic, Polish Roman Catholic, in 1970 in Toledo, Ohio, which means it's pretty substantial. From there, we went to Wapakoneta, Ohio. And by the way, that lends credence to the fact that Neil Armstrong came from Wapakoneta, Ohio, and actually from the age of 10 to 12, I delivered papers to his parents. Now, being a Roman Catholic, I was brought up in very specific ways, yet I would still just like to be considered, as far as names go, average caller, because, Robert, how long is it going to take? Is it going to be the fact that Pepsi is going to introduce the first alien, or is it going to be, something
Pepsi?
That is...
Yeah, Pepsi?
Pepsi or Coke or Doritos or Frito-Lay or whoever introduces the first Vulcan, or the first alien or the first... Or is it going to be the fact that, they finally realize that even a person born Roman Catholic, being an altar boy for 8 years, even a person doing,
What about this person?
Everything about this person has been done right according to Roman Catholicism, who should not believe in aliens, yet still sees the logic in it.
All right, well, so there you have it. Somebody deeply involved in religion, but able to handle this. Well, look, our audience is full of these people who, although they have one belief, swear up and down that all of this would be no problem for them. That they see these things, they deal with them, and their religion, their faith is not challenged in any way whatsoever. But listen, folks, you may need to hear the Lear test one more time. But if half of what John Lear said was true, you too would agree that no, this information could not be out. And Robert, I assume you're saying that at least half or more of what he said was correct.
Oh, more than what he said. He only touched the tip of the iceberg. To answer that young man who said he was brought up a Roman Catholic and he had no problem with this reality, have you heard of, you know who Monsignor Balducci is?
Of course, yes.
Yeah, well, apparently the Vatican has an entire subsection devoted to extraterrestrial communication. That there are Jesuits apparently at work over there and in other parts of the world where they have not only totally accepted the reality of the extraterrestrial presence, but the Vatican has got policy to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact,
the Vatican also has telescopes.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Really big telescopes.
They built one here in Arizona. They violated all kinds of laws and built one over there. Was it Mount Graham somewhere?
This is the truth. I don't know about violating laws. I know they went zipping right through what otherwise should have been an impossible pile of paperwork and authorizations to get this telescope where it is. I mean, they just, like a hot knife through butter.
The government decided that, they were going to have that telescope up there, and the government made the way for them.
Robert, why do you think the Vatican applied that much pressure to get that telescope in that place? What is the Vatican looking for?
Now, at the end of the program, we've reached a point here where you've touched on really dynamite, and that's Nibiru, the 10th planet.
You think that's what they're looking
that's
for?
That's what the government, or the Vatican, wants to be able to photograph and keep track of. Years ago, Art, Robert Harrington, who was the chief astronomer at the United States Naval Observatory, told Zechariah in an interview, he says, "We've seen the 10th planet. We've discovered it. We know it's there. It's real. All we need to do is name it." And Zechariah said to him, he says, "It's already been named. The Sumerians named it. The 10th planet is a reality, Art." And it's...
When the 10th planet passes near Earth again, do you know what is coming?
Well, I can pretty well put together, and I'm only an amateur here. All I know is what happened the last time it made a pass. 1600 B.C. The entire Minoan civilization came to an end. One of the largest volcanoes in the Mediterranean blew its top and literally obliterated the great Minoan civilization. Santorini, they call it, or Thera.
Well, I'm absolutely willing to believe that
1600 BC.
That an object the size of this 10th planet passing close to Earth with the gravitational effects would cause cataclysmic end-of-life-type events.
Art, it depends on whether it and we are on the same side of the sun when it makes its pass. The records are pretty clear that there have been cataclysmic disasters in the past. If it and we are on the same side of the sun when it makes its pass, we're in for a hell of a ride. We're going to have volcanoes and earthquakes and tidal waves that you wouldn't believe. And I believe that the government is aware of that. And I believe that the government is taking steps to try to, do a little planning.
And you think the Vatican's aware of it as well?
Oh, the Vatican is well aware, I'm sure of it.
If some event like this were on the way, you no doubt have the opinion we would not be told, correct?
Oh, no, you're not going to tell you, Art.
And what about the Vatican itself? If the Vatican were to learn that this event was on the immediate horizon, you believe they also would not say anything?
Well, I don't believe they'd make a worldwide announcement, no. I don't know what their emergency plans would be, Art.
Once again, here's Robert Dean. Robert, you're back on the air. Is there anything that we have not covered tonight that you particularly wanted to get on the air?
Well, Art, we were talking about what's happened to the Constitution and how we've allowed this country to turn into a national security state. And that bothers the hell out of me because in all the years I served in the military, I swore to defend with my life the Constitution. And I see that it's been cut and torn apart in little bits and pieces over the years, and it really ticks me off a lot. Now, I don't know what to do about it except to try to get the American people to start waking up and paying attention. But their constitutional system of government, Art, is being taken from them a little bit at a time. It's like the frog in the hot water pot, you know, on the fire?
Yes.
Yeah, you put him in there and then you raise the heat slowly and he never knows until it's too late. I wanted to give you an example here.
I wonder where in this process, Robert, that it's too late.
Yeah, well, I keep hoping maybe it isn't. I know a maverick researcher, a guy, I got a warm spot in my heart for him. A guy I think you know by the name of Hoagland.
Yeah. You know what? Before you dispense this, I want you to dispense. There are in this audience, as you well know, Robert, there's a lot of potential budding UFO researchers, people who have just begun to stumble into some of the evidence. And the things that you have now been through all your life, Robert, what advice would you have for them? In view of what you believe now, what advice would you have for the young budding ufologist?
Well, Art, for those young budding people out there, and I know they're there, and I think they're the future of our country. I have a great love and respect for them. I would tell them to inform themselves and research and learn everything you can. Because as we said from the beginning of the program, this is the greatest story in human history. And it isn't about them, Art. It's not about the guys from out there.
So then you wouldn't discourage them?
No, I encourage them. As a matter of fact, on the website, my wife's website, which is beyondzebra.com, I've got a couple of recommended reading lists, which I've learned over the years and collected and read and, selected and material that I would recommend for these young people to get a hold of some of this material and read, inform themselves, learn all they can, because this is the greatest story in human history, and they've got to learn about it. They can't just let the government con them and lead them down the primrose path. They've got to inform themselves, and research is the only answer.
That's interesting. It's diametrically very different than what John Lear said to my audience. And he basically said, look, these things are true. There's nothing you can do. Forget it. Just enjoy life. Enjoy your family. And don't worry about it.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot you can do, Art. You can inform yourself. You can become knowledgeable. That knowledge takes away the fear.
And for Richard C.?
Oh, Dick has had such a problem with NASA. You know, look what they've tried to do with him on this Mars thing.
Yes.
What is it they say, NASA, never a straight answer?
I don't think they say that. Richard says that.
Well, there's a lot of truth there.
Yeah.
There, you know, the Constitution is in tatters, but maybe it's not too late. NASA is sitting on top of some of the biggest stories in human history. Just to give you an example of this national security state, how bad it's become, did you know that they have photographed a boat on Mount Ararat and it's been classified top secret?
Well, I certainly have seen the photograph, Robert.
But you haven't seen the really good photograph.
You're probably right. Really good photograph?
They're classified, Art. They're classified top secret. I saw one little bit, a piece, that was classified that I was shown, and I couldn't walk away with it.
Well, isn't that interesting?
But it's a boat on Mount Ararat. Now, why in the hell would our government classify that top secret?
I'd have to give that some serious thought.
That gives you some example of the kind of thinking that's going on in government. For example, they've discovered a massive facility under the ice in Antarctica at Lake Vostok.
Boy,
apparently,
it's an alien
facility, and it's at one end of Lake Vostok.
I've heard it about it.
And NASA, what is it? The Jet Propulsion Laboratory was involved with it for one period of time because they were handling the satellites that were taking the deep satellite photographs under the ice. And then all of a sudden, taken away from JPL and turned over to NSA.
All right. Look, a lot of people want to talk to you. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Robert Dean. Good morning.
Good morning, Art.
Hi.
I'm a long-time listener. My name is Robert. I'm in New Mexico.
Yes, sir.
I'm a retired Border Patrol supervisor, and years ago, in 1964, I was stationed in Carlsbad. And my partner and I'd like Mr. Dean to hear this. My partner and I were heading north, and it was late. Well, it was early in the morning, about 3 o'clock. And we turned off the highway out of Roswell heading for Portales. We were going to go up to pick up some aliens being held by the state police. About 3 or 4 miles out of Roswell, we got stopped by a roadblock. State police, air police. It was really wild.
Mm-hmm.
There were helicopters flying all over the place with searchlights. There were jeeps and everything combing there's a lot of sand dunes out there combing around. And we knew the two state police officers had walked back and told us, well, you're going to have to hold you guys up for a while. We said, what's going on? They said, you won't believe this. We're not supposed to talk about it, but you guys being government officers, we'll tell you.
Yeah.
They said, an Atlas missile was accidentally fired in a silo and then blew up partway out of the silo, got partway up through the doors, according to them, and a nuclear warhead flew off of it.
God.
And they said it fell somewhere and they can't find it, and they're frantic. And they've come to the conclusion it must have landed in the highway. Somebody picked it up, and they said, well, if somebody picked it up, they'll find out because whoever picked it up will have radiation poisoning and everything, and then we'll find out. So after a little while, they said, well, you guys in a marked government vehicle, we'll let you on through. So we went on through and drove through, and then about a month later, we ran into one of the officers that we saw that night, and we had to bring it up. We said, whatever happened with that? Did they ever find that nuclear? And he said, yeah, they did, up in Cleveland. He said some old Indian was driving up the highway, and apparently he claimed that it flew off into the road, and he stopped, picked it up, and threw it in the trunk of his car and took it to Cleveland with him, and then 2 weeks later ended up in the hospital with a radiation poisoning. We thought that sounded kind of strange. Well, they said, you haven't heard the worst of it. This is the second one that blew up tonight. I think they said tonight. Two accidentally blown. We couldn't believe that.
Well, if you, I don't know, maybe. Robert, what about it? After all, they did hover over silos. They did move silo covers, as you mentioned, melted one. Then why not what this man said?
Well, I'm convinced, Art, they've been monitoring our ICBM capability for years. Now, whether they caused those atlases to explode or not, I don't know. I know when I was in FEMA, working out of Tucson, we were paying a lot of attention to our problem with the Titan missiles down there. And these Titans were liquid-fueled, and they were leaking all the time, and guys were dying, and they had a couple of problems where they almost launched themselves. So it's been nothing but headache from the very beginning. Now with the Minuteman, it's supposedly a fail-safe unit. You know, it's a solid fuel weapon, and they're not supposed to be able to get out of the silo unless somebody pushes the right button.
Mm.
But there's no question there's been interference, both here and in the Soviet Union.
On the international line, you're on the air with Robert Dean. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bell and Mr. Dean.
Yes.
This may sound like a stretch of the imagination, this type of question, but it's the only one I could come up with. I've studied the Bible to the point of, you know, knowing a little bit more than average about it. And I was wondering if it's possible that this 10th planet that people talk about,
mm-hmm.
could it be something like what Revelations in the King James Bible describes as the New Jerusalem? I mean, that's the only logic I could come up with for its dimension.
And Robert?
Well, it's an interesting point. I don't really know about the New Jerusalem. I read the Bible, and I was raised a Christian, and I think there's a lot of beauty and truth and poetry in the Bible. But this 12th planet, or 10th planet, actually, is apparently 2.5 times the size of the Earth. And it is in an orbit, apparently, where it comes back every 3,600 years. And its last pass, apparently, was 1600 B.C. So it's right on time. And
do the math, yeah.
I suspect we'll probably be seeing a little bit about it, and maybe they'll start releasing a little bit of information here in the next year or so.
Year or so. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Robert Dean. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. First of all, I want to say it's an honor to speak with both of you.
Thank you.
Yes, and Mr. Dean, I have seen a lot of your stuff on TV, and you're a very fascinating person, and thank the human race for having you around. My two questions are, I'll be really brief. My first question is, the four species that you read about when you were in NATO, what did they look like? And my second question is, the mountain you speak about in Alaska, I don't know if you're able to say this or not on the air, but where about is the location of that? And then that's it.
Okay. All right. Thank you. The four species, Robert, what did they look like?
The four different groups that they knew about when they published the assessment in 1964, was all four of them were humanoid. But one of the four was totally human. And that was the thing that bothered the generals and the admirals more than anything else. They had seen them. They had gotten out of their ships and they had talked to people. They had invited people aboard for a ride. They even had photographs of some of them. These guys were so human that they could sit next to you in a theater or a restaurant.
And you wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know the difference. And that bothered the military guys because, you know, being primarily paranoid, as we were all trained to be, the idea that somebody could from another planet could be walking up and down the halls of SHAPE or walking up and down the halls of the Pentagon, that blew them out of the water. This one group looked totally like we are, and I think that's the group, in my opinion, that's probably involved in trying to keep us alive. I think that group is the group that would like to kind of make us, at least hopefully, see us survive. What was the other question?
The other question was about Alaska, Robert,
whether you could
identify.
Well, I don't know that the mountain has a name. I haven't looked at the map in some time, but it was in the southeast corner of Alaska, right up near the British Columbia border. And you can get a hold of Ingo's book, Penetration.
Mm-hmm.
He lays it out pretty clearly. It's a delightful little story of how the guys from DOD took him up there.
Is this awareness of alien presence the main reason you began remote viewing?
I'm sorry, Art, but run that by me.
Is this alien presence that you're convinced of the main reason you began remote viewing?
Well, that and the fact that I would like to get some idea in my mind, like Robert Monroe used to say, to get some idea of where I've come from, why I'm here, and where am I going.
And in your remote viewing, are you satisfied that you got answers to those questions?
Yes, Art, I do. I'm satisfied. I've learned that I am an immortal being, that I'm having just a physical experience here at this particular period in time, and that I came here, I've been here before, apparently.
And all of this is not something that you were sure of before you remote viewed.
No, that's what's interesting about this, that my research into the alien presence has opened doors for me that I never dreamed would be opened. And now remote viewing has, you know, I was talking up to you, Joe, up in Las Vegas here not too long ago.
Yes.
And McMonagle is, in my opinion, one of the top remote viewers.
No question about it.
He's really top operating. He's under, matter of fact, he's under contract to some of the top aerospace companies in this country.
I'm sure he is.
But I talked to him, and he talked to me about how it had opened spiritual doorways for him that had changed his life completely. And that it's done the same thing for me.
One of the things, Robert, that's concerned me about remote viewing is the ability to know the future. I don't know that I want to know the future. I don't want to know perhaps the manner of my own demise. I don't want to know any of that. And so I've chosen not to pursue remote viewing for myself.
Well, Art, that's a choice that you make yourself. When you really get into it, you know, there is no such thing as time. The past, the present, and the future is
that I believe.
All the same.
Yeah, I believe that. And remote viewing looks right across that like it's a clear window. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Robert Dean. Hello.
Yes, hi, Robert Dean. I've been listening to you all night, and there was something I want to ask you. You said you worked for FEMA. Were you aware that there was executive orders of 10995 and 11005 about executive orders to permit FEMA to take over all local, state, and national governments in suspension of constitutional guarantees?
Oh, my, yes.
Yeah. And some of the money that you were talking about that disappeared, I think I have an idea where some of it went to. There's underground cities being built, housing both humans and aliens working with the secret U.S. government.
That might account for $3.5 trillion.
Well, we've been building those underground facilities, Art, for years. We were building those back during the Cold War.
But why for humans and aliens?
Some of them have gotten pretty sophisticated over the years. They're probably, the state of the art has probably gone a lot farther than I would imagine, because I was in some of those underground facilities during the years that I worked with FEMA.
You have personally seen them?
Yeah. Some of those underground facilities, Art, are unbelievable.
Well,
they're like five-star hotels.
Well, Robert, look, I understand that we logically have to have a continuance of government capability in the case of a war.
And we call that COG, continuity of government.
There you are. And we've got to have that. So I'm not surprised we have underground facilities for that. However, if you mix in the alien part of it, I'm not sure what you get. And while you saw these, did you see anything to indicate that it was part of some kind of alien agenda or something?
No, not while I was with FEMA. No, what I saw was it was simply an attempt to have a facility that would help us maintain a continuity of government in the event of a nuclear strike.
That much makes absolute sense to me, and I'm not surprised we have it. I'd be surprised if we didn't. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Robert Dean. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's an honor to speak with you, Mr. Bell.
Thank you.
I've thought of the two perfect questions I want to ask. The first one is, given everything that you've seen in your life and everything that you've read and all of the speculation that you've come to know, I want to know, from your perspective, what's the one thing you've seen or come to know that gives you the most hope or joy or the good? And what's the one thing that you've seen over the years that just strikes fear in the core of your being? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. The best and worst you've seen, Robert?
Well, that's a good question, Art.
That's got to be a fast answer.
Well, I'll tell you this. The worst I've seen is human ignorance. The best I've seen over the years, what I've learned is that God exists.
And you know this comfortably, without any question, as much as you know you are here today.
God exists, Art, and I know that beyond a question of doubt.
Well,
listen, if I may, before you sign off here, I'd like to tell people to go to my website.
Which is?
I've got you know, beyondzebra.com. I've got some recommended reading lists, and there are a few videos and CD-ROMs that I made, and my wife has got a dynamite book called The Confessions of a Intergalactic Anthropologist.
That's almost hard to get out.
I'm married to a bright young woman by the name of Marcia Schaefer.
Buddy, thank you. We got to go. We're out of time. Robert Dean, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.